Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you. Hosted by your local Labour MPs.
Kia ora koutou, ko Julie Ferry tuku ingoa, ko Puki Tāpapa Puki Wiwi te maunga, ko Te Awanga Te Awa, ko Manukau Te Whanganga, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Kia ora, my name's Julie Ferry. I'm the Deputy Chair of the Puki Tāpapa Local Board, one of five Roskill Community Voice Reps on that board of Auckland Council and part of the City Vision centre-left whānau. I have a regular spot on Red Alert Radio. You'll be hearing a little bit more of me over the next little while due to the pre-election period, and I'm very keen to get your feedback. You can find me easily on social media, both Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Julie Ferry, and that's spelt a little bit funny, F for Fred, A-I-R-E-Y. We also now have a Red Alert Radio Facebook page. Search for Red Alert AKL and you should find us. We'll be putting up links to podcasts once they're up online, as well as other bits of useful news relevant to the show. Regular listeners will be familiar with the approach of my sessions, exploring the value that a left progressive approach can bring to local government and our communities. This time we're going in a slightly different direction, but still along the same lines. And one of the reasons I like to talk about this stuff is because the left progressive approach for me is in very stark contrast to the small C conservative approach that held sway in my area of Mount Roskill for most of the last 50 or 60 years, actually, during the old Auckland City Council days. In particular, we had artificially low rates, resulting in neglected infrastructure investment, and meagre council resources weren't used as effectively as they could have been to help and build our community. Progressives, in contrast, aim to work with residents and local groups to get better results for our area than any of us can achieve on our own. So in examining the value that a left progressive approach brings to local government and our communities, I'm aiming to talk to guests who have innovative and interesting ideas about that, making local government and work in our areas, in our neighbourhoods, more relevant to people and more useful too. Over recent months, I've talked to a lot of local board members and chairs from around the Auckland region. You can hear those interviews online at planetaudio.org.nz. Look for Red Alert Radio under R in the programs list. My guest today is not a local board member or chair, or at least not yet, and she's probably most accurately described as a community organiser. Soraya Dord has recently finished up working at both Habitat for Humanity in the International Development Area and Massey Matters as a Community Coordinator. Soraya's just started working in the office of Phil Twyford, the MP for Te Aritu. Her family has long links with the Mount Roskill, Balmoral and Lynfield areas, and the Auckland Muslim Indian community in particular. Her family have been involved right from the start, I think, with Auckland Eid Day each year at the end of Ramadan. I can also personally testify that she's an excellent babysitter. Thanks for joining us today, Soraya. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
First up, I know lots of people will be familiar with the title community organiser, mm-hmm. because that's what Barack Obama was doing before he went into politics. But what does it mean to you, and what does working in community development mean?
So I think the term community organiser was very popular, I think, in the United States, and it probably had less resonance in New Zealand. But now it's starting to get a little bit more traction, I think. Maybe not so much the term, but the idea of someone that works alongside communities to affect change. I've been involved through my work at Massey Matters at more of a neighbourhood-led development approach. So that's a little bit different to, I think, the community organising approach that Obama was part of. And that approach was really about looking at the problems that were in a community and lobbying. Often, you know, in the US, there's city councils or government, and saying, well, we need more resources, or our neighbourhoods are neglected, for example. And it took a very problem-based approach to activate communities. But in this kind of model, it's really looking at more at what the communities have already.
So opportunities.
Or like an assets-based approach.
Yeah.
And then recognising communities, that even if communities might seem to be materially deprived or not have things, that actually there's a lot there. and that everybody has something to bring to the table. And actually often in communities that might be seen to be, you know, deprived in some way or not have as much material good, there might actually be many, many things that can be brought together. But it's the job of the of an organisation or a community group or organisers to kind of bring that together and to kind of just wheel the cogs a little bit to kind of facilitate things to happen, because everybody is doing their stuff in their kind of volunteer time. So I think that is it, you know, and a volunteer effort is really important. I think most things in community will be inevitably led by volunteers that are doing other things as part of their primary activity. But there does need to be some resource put into people that actually dedicate this part as their profession and actually build up that skill base on how to do that. So it's a mix, I think, between you'll have volunteer community organisers and then you'll have paid people, and people will shift between different things, you know, over the course of their life. But I do think it's a really valuable thing to be involved in as a job, really. And that really came from me doing a geography degree. So I did politics and geography at the University of Auckland, but then I found with the geography side it was just a little bit more practical, and I really brought that into bear in lots of my work.
Cool. And I have talked a few months ago to Saffron Toms, who's the deputy chair of the Waitakere Ranges local board.
Yes.
So listeners might want to look that up, because she also studied human geography.
Yeah, she was a tutor of mine at one point.
There we go. And that interview was very much about the connections between human geography and local government and making social change. So that might be of interest to people. Now, you've also been involved in international development, mm-hmm. and I wanted to understand a bit, what's the difference between community development and international development? Do we just call it community when it's somewhere we live, and we call it international when it's somewhere overseas? How does that play out?
I think that is probably quite true. I actually did really think about that quite a lot when I was doing these two roles, because, you know, a few days a week I'd be doing community development, and a couple of days a week I'd be doing international development. And really the difference is what part of the process are you involved in? And also, what is the content knowledge that you need to have?
Right.
So, you know, rightly so, most international development has moved from a direct approach of working to working through partner organisations. And that is actually the same thing that is often happening in community development in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So you have a funder, and then you have a person implementing on the ground. And the person implementing on the ground should ideally be closest to the communities, because they know communities the best.
And that's, right? And that's a basic principle of community development, that you work with what's already there as opposed to trying to impose something new.
Exactly. And so those principles apply across the board. So for international development and community development, it should be the same. So you see, I think, often in Auckland Council, for example, now there's a bigger approach to actually to giving space for community groups to do things at a community level. So either, you know, running community facilities or leading projects or and that is something I think resonates as well in international development. So when I was working at Habitat for Humanity, I was more on the my role was really about kind of designing projects with implementing partners. So that was, you know, in the Habitat for Humanity situation, that was Habitat for Humanity Fiji, and they're very closely on the ground and have been established in Fiji for a very long time, the same amount of time that we've been in New Zealand as well. So they had very strong links. And so we were trying to get funding out of the New Zealand government. So our job was to work with them to design a project that would get that funding from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade. But really, like, the ideas and how to do things and the knowledge was really sitting there in country with the partner. And you're just there to really kind of pull that all together and to have a respectful relationship and find the opportunities for that resource. But you're not the person that is on the ground, and you shouldn't really be the person that's on the ground unless you come from that community. I believe
that must be really hard for people who who like to do the doing,
yeah,
to step back and help others to do the doing. It's something I see in local government quite a lot, where people who are real doers run for the local board and then they get on the local board and they have to actually stop doing.
Mm.
They have to be more involved in the governance and oversight and creating opportunities and making links and passing strategy and policy.
Mm.
And, you know, the temptation to get in there and make your good idea actually happen, as opposed to putting it out and then giving it away to other people, giving that power away to other people, is quite a challenge. So how did that, you've talked about how that plays out in Habitat, in the international development space for you.
Mm.
But how does that, is it the same process in Massey Matters?
I think that was, it was partially, I think in Massey Matters, I think I really enjoyed that I was a little bit more closer to the ground in terms of implementing, because we had that mandate from the local board to do stuff.
And that's the Henderson-Massey local board.
Henderson-Massey local board. So it's a kind of legacy out of the Waitakere City Council, and has been taken on board by the Henderson-Massey local board as well. So there was really good support from there. And also, but then again, it was closer to implementing, but then again, you're working with residents, and the role is to empower residents.
Yeah.
So I managed a fund called the Massey Community Fund, which is about giving money to local residents to lead projects. But my job was really just to support them in that application process and support them with understanding how to do project coordination and run a project, but not to run the project, because that is up to the residents to do. Because it's you're trying to, the whole purpose of this is to empower people. And as a staff member, you know, one day you could easily decide to go, of which I had actually decide to do, and move on to something else. And people have to be left with the skills and the knowledge to do what they need to do. And, and no one should be indispensable, I think.
So it's kind of like that, you know, you're kind of, if you do your job really well, you're making it yourself redundant.
Yes.
Because the power and the skills and the knowledge shift to the community.
Mm-hmm.
Or in a lot of cases, you're bringing out the skills and the knowledge that already were in the community and then giving them the power to act on those skills and knowledge. Mm-hmm. As well. Yeah. It must have been quite tricky work, I'm sure, but also very rewarding.
Yeah, it was very rewarding. And I think it's given me a lot of understanding of, you know, basic skills like project coordination and project management and working with stakeholders. And when you come out of my journey towards this is very much through the university and knowledge and academia and coming to the community practical stuff a little bit later, whereas many people that work in community come to the community stuff first and then the theory kind of comes a little bit later.
Yeah.
And so I had to teach myself how to term these things and understand what skills it was that I was developing, and that took a long time, and it took a lot of conversations with people and a little bit of reading to discover, like, okay, well, I'm doing these things in my roles, what is it actually that I'm doing that other people would recognise, because we're working in, you know, a little bit of a niche field.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about it, in community and political work and organising, if you were to talk to most people, if you talk to them that you said that you were, you know, an accountant or a marketing person, or understand that.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
our work is a little bit challenging for people to understand because it is quite particular.
Yeah,
I think.
And it's one of the things I talked about with Joe Bartley, who's chair of the Maunga Kiakea Tāmaki local board, a couple of months ago, was we talked about transferable skills that we were talking particularly there about the Pacific community and the fact that a lot of the leaders there have experience on church committees and, you know, often organising quite significant events and running large budgets and things like that. They don't necessarily see those skills as similar skills to what you need to, for example, be on a local board.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I often think about the negotiation skills that you need when you're a parent with a child, and indeed with your partner often, and that those negotiation skills and those interpersonal relationships that you have in your family, often they are the same skills that you need to use in a corporate or a public service environment as well. Yeah, so that's interesting.
I think that's true, definitely. That it's recognizing what you do have as part of actually just being a human and having human interactions. I think most of the value that I brought to my roles was actually just the interpersonal stuff. So it's actually, and that's, you know, what is called stakeholder relationships, but it's really just listening to people and understanding them and being respectful in your engagement with them, and that goes 90% of the way.
And that's quite a good segue, actually, to the next topic I wanted to talk to you about in terms of being respectful. And, you know, you are Muslim, Muslim woman, young Muslim woman in New Zealand. Have you lived here your whole life?
Yeah. So I was born here.
Yeah, I thought you were. Just checking. And I know that that's a really important part of your identity and the way that you live your life. So one of the things I was thinking about is Michael Joseph Savage once described socialism, which he was in favour of, as applied Christianity. And I wondered how you see the link between social justice and the community work that you've done and your faith.
It's very directly related, and I think, and that comes off, and I learned that very much from my parents, because they had a very strong association between social justice and faith, that there was a, you know, theoretically, there is a equality within Islam between and amongst people, and that, and much of that was to do with economic equality, so seeking to bridge the divide between people that were wealthy and people that were poor, and always actually looking to lift people up and support people in your community, in your neighbourhood. And they just had that ethic, just always trying to help people. And I very much felt that as being very related to their faith as well. And I think that cuts across to many people from many different faith backgrounds.
Yes,
but they had a very practical element to their spirituality, I think. So they weren't, you know, overly religious in terms of expecting themselves or expecting other people to do lots of particular types of things, but they lived it in terms of how they interacted with people. And I mean, they still do. But, you know, as with most faith communities, the practical, the theoretical doesn't quite always align to a, you know, how do institutions and how do organisations actually operate. So at the moment I've been thinking a lot about that. I think many Muslim people within their own lives, within their family lives, do enact these values quite strongly, believe in them. Theoretically it's all there in terms of social justice and fairness and equality and empowering people. We have a very, even on a spiritual level, there's a strong sense of egalitarianism between men and women in terms of having the same spiritual kind of position. And also lots of really good allowances, I think, for women based on the practical realities of women's lives as well, that I think are very progressive when you actually think about what does it actually mean to have equity. But the way that that plays out at a community level isn't often very good.
Right.
And so what is deemed to be progressive, so for example, women have dispensations not to have to go to the mosque on a Friday, and what that ends up being is that women don't go, or there isn't space made for them, or there isn't space for them made within management or governance, because, well, we have this dispensation not to go, so therefore why would you ever want to be a part of community level stuff? So it plays out in a really perverse way what is actually scripturally or literally actually quite an empowering thing.
So it's supposed to be an exception that acknowledges the other roles and the nature of life for women.
Yes.
And in fact it gets used more as almost a prohibition.
Yes.
Right.
So that's something that I'm kind of just trying to think through a little bit at the moment, just in my own kind of understanding. But and many of those things used to make me very angry, I think, as a young person, and frustrated. And I possibly am coming back to that point again. But for very But what I've also come to realise is actually, like, you have to park that a little bit, because it can be quite damaging to your own spirituality to just be angry about things. So instead, I think part of what I've been trying to do is actually just cultivate my own relationship with the divine, with God, at a personal level, and do the work that I need to do on myself internally, to let that go a little bit, to still care about it, still be passionate about it, still talk about it, still want to seek change. And but also not let that damage me too much. And I think that's people that are involved in faith communities or political organizations many times have to do that, you know, where you're like, okay, this is good for me, I need to be part of this, because it gives me my sense of community and it gives me my sense of participation, and it, and I believe and I'm passionate about the values, but this part of it is not good.
Yeah.
And I'm going to keep working on that, but I'm not going to let it damage the good stuff that I get out of it.
Yeah,
as well.
It's a tricky balance. I mean, for some people it's like that in their families too, you know. Think about relationships, say with my father, and we went through a period of really not getting on very much at all, and it took me a long time to come to terms with that he was still actually quite a loving, lovely person, even though we disagreed about X and Y. And it took us both a long time, I think, to sort of rub the edges off it so that it became a tender spot in terms there were calluses there for us rather than it being tender every time we poked there. We knew we had a hole. We weren't totally healed up, but we were able to communicate and connect and acknowledge the good things about each other instead of always going back to the tender spot. So one of the things that I'm curious about, and you've talked about sometimes how some of the dispensations for women get turned into sort of rules that can restrict women in the Muslim faith. And I think that's a common perception from outside, that there are a lot of restrictions on women that don't apply to men. I mean, from our acquaintance, I know that's not necessarily the case. What would your advice be to any Muslim woman who are looking to get more involved in their community, or perhaps even to think about playing a leadership role?
I think the best way that I have found for myself is to find something that you can really get involved with outside of the Muslim community that's going to teach you a lot of the skills that you need to learn. Because, and that's what I found, one of the most empowering things for me that has ever happened, and it seems strange from people when I talk to people about it, but actually was when I got involved in student politics and the Labour Party. That just opened up a whole world for me that I had never understood was possible. And that was that I could be at the table. So then I learnt that I could be at the table, and that I was good when I was around the table, and that I was valued, and that my contribution was meaningful, and that I actually did add something. And so that was huge. I think it was revolutionary for me to go through that and to have that acknowledged by my peers, because I very much didn't feel like that in high school or in primary school. That conception didn't really exist for me there. And school is often not that kind of environment, I think. So find something that really gives you that. It might be any type of little group, you know. And then try and find the groups, once you've kind of done that for yourself, try and find the groups within the Muslim community that are doing that. Because I know there are small groups. It's not the majority. It's not the mainstream. And I can only really speak, I have to say that I can only really speak for the mainstream of the Sunni Muslim community, because I know that other communities are different, and I can't really speak for what their situation is like. But then find the groups that give you that, allow you to be there, where it's a respectful environment, where the men are good and acknowledge you as being, you know, valued, and value your contribution and respect your contribution and treat you as equals. And then I think just strip away at things slowly. you know, just slowly chip away at things and build your people around you, I think. And it's a hard slog, and, you know, this stuff will probably take generations to change, but it's worth it. Because I know for the men that I have around me, or the my cousins, and I know with my husband as well, they're starting to get things.
Yeah.
And understand, you know, that they actually have a role in breaking down this patriarchal system. And banging your head against the currently powerful people is probably not going to be that helpful. I don't think they really want to change, or they're in the position to want to give up any power.
Got to work around them.
Yeah. But I think there are younger guys that actually, you know, recognize that actually women have a lot to contribute, sometimes actually, you know, a lot more to contribute, because they tend to be involved in community,
yeah,
as well. So that experience is really valuable when you're actually working in community as well. So it's a bit of a juggle and a bit of a balance, but you've just got to find your little spaces and grow those spaces.
Cool. And I mean, I have to say, hearing you talk, I can think of, you know, that's equally applicable to the Christian community.
Mm.
You know, that there are parts of the Christian community where women are not acknowledged as, how do I put this politely, not acknowledged as able to do some of the things that men can do.
Mm.
And, you know, finding a project or something that you can get passionate about for yourself, finding allies within your community, but also support mechanisms outside your community, and keeping chipping away and, you know, making change slowly but surely. You know, that applies in other communities too.
I used to, probably when I was younger, think in probably a much more dramatic, like, I would be like, oh, well, I would just go and just, like, protest about this. And actually some of my spiritual kind of development has cautioned me away from that a little bit, because it's like, what happens afterwards?
Yeah.
It's like, do actually more walls go up sometimes?
Yeah.
And I definitely believe that when you're trying to achieve an end, that the means to how you achieve that end is also very important. And are you living your values?
Yeah.
While you're trying to make that change, and if your values are about trying to build community, are you dividing community in that process, or are you building community? And so the process, I think, is just about as important as the ends.
So thinking then about some of the stuff you've been involved in, what would be your favourite project that you've worked on so far?
I'm always really bad at choosing favourites. Absolutely.
What's the first one that comes to mind then?
Well, I think while I was working at Habitat, I felt very proud of the fact that we're very close to, and by August we should know, that a big project to get funding for building housing in Fiji.
Yeah.
So that was huge for me, because I felt, my dad is from Fiji, so it was very moving for me to be involved in something that was so close to his place.
Yeah, and I know you've spent some time in Fiji too.
Yeah, so I did spend some time doing some field work there last year. And yeah, that was just a very special time for me. Because, it's when migration is always really hard, and he was really passionate about the place and really, you know, felt like that was his home,
yeah,
for a very long time. And we haven't had that connection, obviously, because we're very much New Zealanders, but I'm still very proud of it, and I'm glad that I got to spend some time doing something in a place that was important to my dad.
That's great. Thank you so much for coming in, Sarah. I really appreciate that. And thanks for listening, folks. I look forward to your feedback via Twitter or Facebook. And you can find us on Red Alert Radio, AKL, on Facebook. Thanks very much. Ka kite anō.
Get together with your local MP next week at 9:05 a.m. Or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalert.